Jerry Bader Show, 10:35. I actually do need to double back to Ferguson, Missouri for just a moment because I teased this and I teased it yesterday and didn't get to it, and I want to get to this. I actually teased it 2 days ago. What's missing in Ferguson, Missouri? Joseph Epstein, writing in the Wall Street Journal, back actually Wednesday. The lead item on much television news since the weekend has been the shooting in Ferguson, Missouri, a suburb of St. Louis, of 18-year-old Michael Brown by a police officer. On display was what has now become the fairly standard response in these matters, and boy, does he nail this. The inconsolable mother, the testimony of the dead teen's friends to his innocence, the aunts and cousins chiming in, the police chief's earnest promise of a thorough investigation. The death in Ferguson added to the mix 3 nights of protests and looting, with police using tear gas and rubber bullets to quell the crowds. But otherwise, the feeling was not dissimilar from what we saw 2 years ago after the shooting of Trayvon Martin in Sanford, Florida. The same lawyer who represented the Martin family, it was announced, is going to take this case. Missing, not that anyone is likely to have noticed, was the calming voice of a national civil rights leader of the kind that was so impressive during the 1950s and 60s. In those days, there was Martin Luther King Jr. of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, Roy Wilkins of the NAACP, Whitney Young of the National Urban League, Bayard Rustin of the A. Philip Randolph Institute, all solid, serious men, each impressive in different ways, who, through dignified forbearance and strategic action, brought down a body of unequivocally immoral laws aimed at America's black population. The NAACP and the Urban League and Southern Christian Leadership Conference still exist, yet few people are likely to know the names of their current leaders. That is because no black leader has come forth to set out a program for progress for the substantial part of the black population that has remained for generations in the slough of poverty, crime, and despair. In their place today, there is only Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton, each of whom long ago divested himself of the moral force required of true leadership. And this is a great point that I hadn't really thought about. One of the small but genuine accomplishments of President Obama has been to keep both of these men from becoming associated with the White House. In Chicago, where I live, he writes, much of the murder and crime that has captured the interest of the media is black on black and cannot be chalked up to racism, except secondarily by blaming the old hobgoblin, the system. People march with signs reading Stop the Killing, but everyone knows that the marching and the signs and sweet sentiments of local clergy aren't likely to change anything. Better education is needed, politicians say. Perhaps a longer school day. Jobs, yes, more and better jobs. That's what's required. Got to get the guns off the street, everyone says. The black family, the absence of fathers is the problem. The old dead analyses, the pretty panaceas, are paraded. Yet nothing new is up for discussion. Discussion itself is off the table, except when Bill Cosby, Thomas Sowell, or Shelby Steele, and a few others have dared to speak about the pathologies at work, and for doing so, these black figures are castigated. President Obama, as leader of all the people, is not well positioned for the job of leading the black population that finds itself mired in despond. Someone is needed who commands the respect of his or her people and the admiration of the vast, I would argue, preponderate number of middle-class whites who understand that progress for blacks means progress for the entire country. The older generation of civil rights leaders proved its mettle through physical and moral courage. The enemy was plain. Rearguard segregationists of the Old South, and the target was clear. Wrongful laws that had to be and were rescinded. The morality of the matter was all on these leaders' side, in Little Rock, in Montgomery, in Selma, and elsewhere. They put their lives on the line, and they won. The situation today for a civil rights leader is not so clear, and in many ways more complex. After the victories half a century ago, civil rights may be a misnomer. Economics and politics, and above all, culture, are now at the heart of the problem. Blacks, largely and inexplicably, remain pledged to a political party whose worn-out ideas have done little for them while claiming much, referring to Democrats. Slipping off the too comfortable robes of victimhood is essential, as is discouraging everything in ghetto culture that is dead end marked all over it. The task is enormous. The person likely to bring it off, a modern day Moses, able to lead his people out of the desert, nowhere in sight. Until that person or persons arrives, we can expect more nights like those in Ferguson, with cries of racism, with looters and bottom feeders turning up, with sadness all round. That, Joseph Epstein, this week in the Wall Street Journal. I have nothing to add to that. Beginning today, there is a 45th anniversary. 45 years ago today, August 15th begun, I believe it's either 3 or 4 days, 15, 16, 4 days, 4-day Woodstock concert in New York State. And of course, it's getting all the laudatory coverage that you would expect. It is considered the defining moment of the 1960s. If you could take the counterculture movement, anti-war movement of the late 1960s, and if you're looking for one moment in time that defines it, you would be hard-pressed to top Woodstock. Not that there aren't contenders, and some are much darker than Woodstock. Kent State, campus bombings. Probably, if you're going to disagree with me, and were I to disagree with myself, which does happen from time to time, the 1968 convention. And maybe they're bookends. Actually, the more I think about that, they would probably have to be bookends. Because of the riots and unrest in Chicago at the 1968 convention, certainly a defining moment. And maybe there isn't just one. But in terms of characterizing the mood of the counterculture movement, you'd be hard-pressed to top Woodstock. I got to thinking about something. So what is Woodstock? It is a historic concert. My daughter has no idea. She has no idea. Tell you what you do. Search Wide Orbit Cart Library. See if you can find Woodstock in one of the music. It's a song by Crosby, Stills, Nash. I don't think it's Anne Young. Maybe it is. I forget when Neil Young was there. Anyway, it is remembered fondly. 500,000 people were there. Nothing. 500,000 people were there. Few of them actually heard the music. It was mostly sex and drugs and nudity in the mud. But I got to thinking about this. What was Woodstock? Woodstock was an event that lost money. It was a financial failure. It was an organizational failure. But liberals think it was the greatest thing in the world. So Woodstock is a template for modern liberal government. Never occurred to me. Completely disorganized, completely wasteful, chaotic, bordering on anarchy, loses money, but liberals feel good about it. That's it. It's in a microcosm. It is liberalism. It is. It's their fondest, by far, it is the most celebratory moment for the left in the 20th century, second half of the 20th century. No doubt about it. It's liberalism. That's what it is. Speaking of liberalism, you know about when Harry met Sally, when Barack met Hillary again. We'll get to that in 3 minutes. It's 10:46.
Join the Jerry Bader Facebook fan page. Go to jerrybadershow.com.